The Tom Woods Show, episode 2116.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. This is an interview I did just this week on the radio out in Tampa, Florida, where David Gornosky has his program, A Neighbor's Choice. And our friend Jeff Deist, president of the Mises Institute, hosts it on Mondays. And he had me on to talk about the decline of what we might call the legacy media and the rise of people writing on platforms like Substack, who are building up enormous audiences, and what this all means for society. So I think it's a great topic of conversation. And I think we had a very interesting and provocative conversation. And yet I fear most people will not hear it because most of you don't live in Tampa. So the Tom Woods Show to the rescue. Here it is, my conversation with Jeff Deist on the radio. Enjoy.
Tom, how are you?
Doing well, Jeff. Glad to talk to you.
So just thinking earlier today, some of our audience might not know you. I've known you for a long time, and I was thinking to myself, wow, Tom, I wonder if back in the 1990s, when you were going through a couple of Ivy League degrees, getting a PhD in history, could you have ever imagined, fast forward to 2022, that you would reach as big an audience as you do today, and that you would do so via the mechanisms and platforms which you use?
No. And of course, when I think back to the kinds of things I want to do for a living, think back to what any kid wants to do for a living. You know, kid wants to be a fireman, an astronaut, or whatever. I couldn't have said, well, I think I'd like to host a podcast and reach, you know, a gazillion people, or I'd like to send out an email newsletter that reaches a gazillion people. These things didn't exist. There was no way to anticipate it. And yet, every day, I just open up my computer, I plug in a simple microphone, and the world is my oyster. It's an astonishing world.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And I can't help but think the fact that people like you and a lot of others like you who reach a lot of people now via independent means, I guess we could, in a sense, among other things, call you an independent journalist or commentator of sorts. I can't help but think that the proliferation of people like you has something to do with the absolute screeching we're seeing over this Elon Musk purchase of Twitter.
Oh, you would think there would be people who would be ashamed to be taking that view, which in effect is an anti-free speech view. You're saying that free speech, you know, is a bad thing, and it's got you scared, it's got you nervous. I saw this Sean King, you know, the race hustler Sean King, said today that the thing with somebody like Elon Musk buying Twitter is that this is a power play for white nationalism, is what he says. He says that the reason people like Elon Musk want so-called free speech on Twitter is that they are upset that right now white nationalists are not allowed to bully or harass people, and they want to overturn that. I mean, I'd like to say that person is tone deaf, but I don't think he could be that stupid. Mm-hmm. Imagine portraying our point of view quite like that. But yes, incidentally, what reminds me of my own situation from all this is that I'm quite sure that a lot of what I write makes a lot of people screech, but there's no real way for them to stop it because I use an email autoresponder service to power my newsletter. And even if on the extremely unlikely chance that my autoresponder service kicked me off, I always have the email list as my own property and I can take it to Berserker Mail. Berserker Mail is a no censorship email autoresponder platform where you can send out email newsletters. So the censors ultimately, they can't control the entire internet. There's always some corner where the free thinkers can exist and thrive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if they were going to control it, they would have done better by now. Some days I wake up and I'm actually shocked at the degree of freedom we have. And I always wonder if 10 or 20 years from now, we'll look back and say, oh my gosh, remember when you could just tweet? But when I read this tweet by an absolute fraud like Sean King, I wonder if he's even aware that across much of the Anglosphere in other legal systems, especially in the UK, he could be thoroughly sued by Elon Musk for calling him a white nationalist or something like that. I mean, these people who were against free speech sure like to use it themselves.
Yeah. And of course, when has Elon Musk ever said anything that remotely suggests that he's a white nationalist? So this is just a phrase now that they just throw around at everybody. So I would just urge people, you hear somebody called that name, automatically assume it's not true. Automatically assume. And you will be correct 99.9 with a bar over it percent of the time. Now, none of these people care anything about the truth. They just care about destroying the enemy. And the enemy is somebody who wants people to hear a point of view other than what Mitt Romney and Hillary Clinton want you to hear. That is basically it. You're the dangerous person if you're outside the Romney to Clinton axis.
Yeah. And what also strikes me is there's no sense amongst people that this stuff can be weighted properly. I mean, if you're one person on Twitter with a small following and you're saying outlandish things, well, okay, a few people are going to hear you and most people are probably going to disregard you. Whereas if you're Wolf Blitzer on CNN and you're saying outlandish things, but fortunately, a lot of people are going to accord that great weight. Actually, a friend of both of ours, John Tamney, who's a financial writer at Forbes and Real Clear Markets, he said something interesting a year or so back at one of our events. He said, you know, for all of its faults and all of its deplatforming and all of its algorithms and censorship and da-da-da, and he said, social media was really important to us during COVID. It was really the one place and the only place, Tom, where we were getting any kind of alternative information on lockdowns, on masks, on vax, on stats, where a lot of these doctors who took brave stands like Jay Bhattacharya, a lot of these people became internet famous. And so in a sense, we're living in great times. We should be thankful.
It is true that if you wanted to find alternative voices, you could find them. They were out there. That is true. I have to say, Jeff, I have gone back and forth on this one, though. I've been wondering, was the internet, and I make my living on the internet. I couldn't live without it. So I'm a big, big cheerleader of it. But I wonder, did the internet in some ways aid and abet this ridiculous, unscientific regime we lived under for 2 years, in the sense that, yes, it's true that we could find some dissident voices. But if there hadn't been Zoom, if it hadn't been possible, like technically possible, to do school at home, would we have done school at home? If it hadn't been technically possible to work from home, would we have worked from home? And moreover, the images, some of which were indeed transmitted through social media, of people wearing masks and being compliant and spreading the same language about social distancing to the far corners of the earth, could they have gotten away with such a uniform implementation of these crazy rules everywhere? So I don't know. I kind of come down on both sides of this.
Well, that's true of not just the internet, but the digital world. Would there have been global lockdowns and basically a somewhat similar global response to this pandemic in any earlier era? And I think the answer is no. It would have been localized to where there were hotspots.
At least the silver lining here is that the American federal system, by which, of course, we mean the relationship of the states to the federal government, turns out to have been way, way healthier than I thought it was. That we still, unlike in some countries, power is divided in the U.S. And even though Joe Biden, I'm sure, but more than that, Dr. Fauci, the kinds of policies he wanted to implement, he couldn't get away with it. There would have been too much resistance. And of course, we had Ron DeSantis. We had people at the local level saying, we're not going along with it. I think there was much more of that in the U.S. than there was in any other country.
I think that's true. And in a sense, did the COVID crisis give you an opportunity to define yourself, to become more famous, to grow your own income, and to become, you know, more entrenched in your business?
It did, but thing is, I would rather pump gas for a living if the minimum wage had destroyed that job, you know, than do this. I would rather live in a free society where I pump gas than in a society where I'm wealthy because I'm telling people that Dr. Fauci is full of it, you know? But but it is true that my mailing list doubled in just a matter of months because people felt like I was a voice who was telling them they're not crazy. I wasn't just telling them the truth that were being left out or the charts nobody was seeing. But I was reassuring them that you're not the crazy one. You're not crazy. You're surrounded by crazy people, but you're actually the normal person. And it turns out I was providing a service that a lot of people desperately needed.
Yeah, that's so true. And a lot of big names were created, I think, during the COVID crisis. And after the break, I want to talk a little bit more about this. But let's just throw out some of these names. And some of our listeners will be familiar with them because they've been guests on the show. Dr. McCullough, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, Dr. Aaron Cariotti, are writers like Alex Berenson over on Substack, like Ian McCall, who wrote the book Unmasked, like Glenn Greenwald, who left The Intercept and has been extremely active on Substack and other places since all this happened. You know, it really is an interesting time if we think about it that way. Tom, we just got a minute left. So when we come back from the break, I want to get your thoughts about some of these alternative media superstars and what it means for the CNNs and the MSNBCs and the ABCs of the world, because it feels to me like, on the one hand, we have a proliferation of alternative media voices. We have a splintering into, you know, little slight ideological camps where people can go consume whatever sort of political or ideological or economic media they want to consume. But yet we're all sort of routing this through a couple of big channels like Twitter. And so there's some wonderful decentralization happening. There's also some concerning centralization happening financially and otherwise, which I would lay largely at the feet of big government and central banks. But there's a lot to consider. And I think it's important here on David Gornowski's show that we are promoting optimism on this. We'll be right back. This is News Talk 1040. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. I'm your host, Jeff Dice. Glad to be joined by a friend of mine, Tom Woods. You can find him at tomwoods.com and follow him on Twitter and on various other social media platforms to keep abreast of everything he's doing with some of his private groups, his Liberty Classroom, his Tom Woods School of Life, and some other projects, which are really pretty amazing if we think about what new media allows us to do. And Tom, I was mentioning this sort of anger and existential dread that the legacy media, people like Brian Stelter at CNN, feel about Elon Musk buying Twitter. And we got to, I think, touch at least briefly upon this same angst and vitriol has been aimed at our mutual friend, Glenn Greenwald, who's really been a hero, I think, of new media.
Glenn has been great. He's been hosting a lot of his material on Rumble, where he thinks it'd be less likely to be taken down than on YouTube. And Glenn is somebody who he clearly has left-wing sympathies. I mean, you see him talk about the situation in Brazil. You see him talking about economics. There's no question about that. But he wants his side to be honest. And it, in a way, it reminds me kind of what people like you and I were doing, people like me and Mises Institute people, when we wanted to keep Republicans honest. In the 1990s, they were going to, of all possible things they could say about Bill Clinton, they were going to try him for perjury over that one thing and yet let the million other things the guy did just go uncommented on. They were the kind of things where he's willing to attack his own side and say, you're hypocrites, you're liars, you're full of it, you're promoting a narrative that's not true. And in the course of doing that, yes, he's made a lot of enemies. He's made enemies that really would like to see him literally dead. But at the same time, I don't know how many Substack subscribers he has or whatever it is, but I would not be surprised if he was living a very, very financially prosperous life, because an independent voice like his is so rare in our day and age that people are thirsting for it, and they'll pay $5 a month for it.
Well, here's the thing. Progressives have almost forced us into a corner on this. They're going to call Joe Rogan a right-winger. They're going to call Elon Musk a right-winger. They're going to call Glenn Greenwald a right-winger. In other words, anyone who's not with them is a Trumper, a fascist, a right-winger, whatever it might be. And so, you know, it's almost like it's come down to reasonable versus unreasonable people. Because as you say, we were trying to hold Republicans accountable in the early 2000s when they were going into Iraq, and when John Yoo and John Ashcroft were coming up with this unlawful detention and renditions and Guantanamo Bay and all these, the Patriot Act and all these other illegal things. So it hasn't worked. This idea that we're neither left nor right and we're neutral and they're the bad guys, you know, it hasn't worked. And so I think we find ourselves on the same side as Glenn Greenwald. I'm just not sure that side has to be ideological anymore.
It really boils down to this. Do you look at the American establishment? And by that, I mean the kind of people who would be appointed to chair the Federal Reserve System. So not just Jerome Powell, but anybody who would be in line for that. So the head of the Federal Reserve, let's say the Hillary Clinton to Mitt Romney axis, the major corporate CEOs with their, you know, their publicly written letters letting us know that they have all the officially approved opinions on everything. You look at all these people, and do you say to yourself, these are really impressive people? These are really smart, impressive people who have done great things for America. I don't see how you can. I don't see how you look at a foreign policy created by Joe Biden, Joe Lieberman, and George W. Bush. Basically, there is, you could barely slide a credit card between them in terms of the differences on foreign policy. They've created this mess of a foreign policy that's given us nothing but grief and a lot of wasted trillions of dollars over the past 20 years. Are you going to look at those and say, these are really, really insightful people? I don't see how you can. And so to me, the real divide is between people who want to side with the American establishment come what may, and the rest of us who say the American establishment has been a disaster for the American public, and it's obvious on every level. And so, no, I am not going to confine myself to the choice of opinion that the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Washington Press Corps give me. I'm pretty sure that life is about more than just Hillary versus Mitt, given that the two of them are half the time indistinguishable.
Oh, and one thing that I think Trump got that the left increasingly doesn't get is what it really comes down to, Glenn Greenwald doesn't hate my guts. Glenn Greenwald doesn't wish ill upon me and my family. And I think a lot of people in, I guess what we could call the commentariat, in intelligentsia, in the digerati at places like the New York Times and places like MSNBC, I truly believe they do hate my guts. And they do wish ill upon my family for not sharing their worldview. And maybe that's today's distinction.
Yeah, I think it is. And so meanwhile, then, parents who would like to have their children educated by people who can at least stand the sight of them now become domestic terrorists for wanting that. And that is basically where things are. So right now, we have a lot of independent people who use a platform called Substack to get their news out there. And it's a very easily monetizable newsletter platform. People can comment on what you've written. You can have some content that you have to pay for, some you give away for free, and you can actually make a living doing it. And we have people on that platform who have bigger audiences than, if not the cable news networks, then let's say certainly they have bigger audiences than some of the programs on those networks just through Substack. Now, you may say, well, that's all good and everything, but the problem is only people who are ideologically of like mind are ever going to see those people's Substack. You know, the viewers on CNN will never get to see that. And so the whole country won't get to see it. Only people who already agree. But the thing is, that's the world we live in right now. We already live in a world where people are going to go to the sources. They're going to tell them what they want to hear. That's already a fait accompli. There's nothing we can do about that. That's the world we live in. Now the question is, how can we most effectively get our message out to people who are most likely to be receptive to it? And we have these platforms. Substack has been very good, to my knowledge at least, about not shutting people down for saying unpopular things and not demonizing people because they're outside the Romney to Clinton axis. And that's a great step forward, even if it does point to the ideological segregation of America, the intellectual segregation of America. Unfortunately, that's where we've been placed by the very American establishment we've been talking about. These people have made their hatred for middle America clear. So middle America has fled from them and gone to other sources.
Well, I mean, we have two distinct choices. One is ideological monoculture, and one is ideological segregation. I'll take the segregation all day long. I mean, yes. The only place I subject myself to CNN is in an airport lounge when I'm waiting for a flight. And look at CNN Plus. Yeah, let's pay extra for more Don Lemon and more Brian Stelter every month. I mean, I'd pay money to have less of those two guys, right? And so it's become such a saccharine enterprise, this idea that our superiors, people like Wolf Blitzer, have to sort of tell us how to think. And it's always been that way. I think it was just less obvious. When I was a young kid, there was Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather and people like that. So there's always been this sort of ideological conformity, but I think a lot of the mask has dropped. In other words, the media has no longer pretending to represent us or to just tell us the straight scoop down the middle and not to hate our guts, in effect. So this all strikes me as very interesting. And Tom, when you say, you know, some Substack writers have a bigger audience, look, there are plenty of great podcasts out there getting millions upon millions of views. The average cable show on the old networks, I mean, the big ones like Tucker Carlson, a little bit less Sean Hannity. I mean, they get 3 million, 2 million. The lesser ones, a lot of them on CNN are pulling 100, 200,000 people. So compared to certain TikTok accounts, certainly compared to certain YouTube accounts, compared to a lot of Twitter feeds, a lot of Instagram models, a lot of Snapchat people, this is an absolute revolution. And Tom, what's happening here is that the powers that be at the legacy media, they just got behind the curve on this. They don't know what to do. They're hemorrhaging viewers. They're hemorrhaging money. They're hemorrhaging sponsors. They just had a big, you know, new merger at CNN. So they pulled the plug on CNN Plus, hundreds of millions of dollars down the drain after less than a month of implementation. I mean, we're in for a dramatic restructuring. And if there was ever an industry which deserves to be disrupted, which deserves to be turned on its head, it is basically the old-fashioned TV news industry, because it's an absolute abomination. When we come back from the break, I want to pick Tom's brain a little bit more about some of the specific things he does, because homeschooling is going to be huge in the future. It's growing in leaps and bounds, and just ways that we can all educate ourselves and work around the traditional or expensive modes of media, the traditional and expensive modes of education. There's so much happening out there in the online world, and you may not be fully aware of it. And that's why we need people like Tom out there leading the way. We got to take a quick break. This is News Talk 1040 WHBO. We'll be right back with more from Tom Woods. Stay with us, folks. Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm your host, Jeff Dice. We're talking to the great Tom Woods, a friend of mine. You can find his work at tomwoods.com, among other places. Tom, I wanted to mention to you that if there's one thing that our overlords fear even more than independent media and independent journalism, I think it's homeschooling. And as you well know, the homeschooling movement's received a tremendous shot in the arm due to these COVID shutdowns, these poor little kids being forced to wear masks or sit at home with some Zoom call while their, you know, parents were off at work. It was just an absolutely terrible time. So not only is homeschooling exploding, but as some of our listeners might not know, supposedly, the single fastest segment of homeschoolers is Black folks who are increasingly unhappy with the lack of value they're getting from their oftentimes poor local schools in certain urban settings. I mean, that's just a fact. So what do you think the horizon is for this? I mean, what are the possibilities here? This strikes me as far more important than any, you know, political activism we could go be involved in, get this guy or that guy elected.
Well, it's true, because you won't be sitting in a classroom that is aimed at making you compliant or is just liable to accept what you're told. And that's a hugely important thing for young people. Now, of course, I have a bit of a bias here because I played a significant role in creating Ron Paul's homeschool program. So Ron Paul's program, I actually created the headline we have is, if you're a homeschooling parent, you're probably working too hard. And what we mean by that is that with the Ron Paul curriculum, it's video-based and it's self-taught. So after about the fourth grade, the student can just go through the stuff without really needing external help. But the idea of it is, not only is it going to teach them something other than the standard textbook version of events about every last thing on earth, but it also teaches them the sorts of things that no school is teaching them, which is how to manage your money. Nobody's teaching kids that. Or how to be an effective public speaker. It's great to teach kids great ideas, but if they can't communicate them, what good is it? So we teach them that. We teach them how to start your own home business. So in other words, the kinds of things that help to make you a genuinely free and independent person who is a slave to nobody. So I'll say it's one of the handful of things I'm proudest of. So that program is at ronpaulhomeschool.com. We've got tremendous feedback from parents about it. But the amazing thing about it is how long it took before we got something like this. You think about the conservative movement and the hundreds of millions of dollars they blow on these think tanks every year, like these foundations that produce policy papers. Not one of them ever thought, what if we created a homeschool curriculum K through 12? It never dawned on them. Instead, let's write some policy report about why the highway budget should be 1.3% less than it is. What an absurd waste of money over these years.
Yeah, and homeschooling strikes me as a real existential threat to the regime, because you've got kids who are becoming independent. And I wouldn't say it's inherently conservative. There are plenty of folks, especially on the more granola side of the left, who believe in unschooling or free-range parenting, Montessori. I mean, there's always been also a left element. It hasn't just been, as the media portrays it, this kind of kooky right-wing Bible types who don't want their kids being exposed to all the cool kids at school and getting socialized. Well, look at the socialization that happened in public schools the last 2 years with these sick, sadistic teachers lording it over little kids with masks. I mean, no thanks. If that's the socialization available to my kids, I'll take a pass on that. But this strikes me, Tom, as so important in the future. And unlike Europe, I mean, there's a few areas where we really outpace Europe in terms of, you know, we have a greater degree of firearm freedom here, certainly, but homeschooling freedom as well. I mean, this is really cut down on. It's basically outlawed in a big country like Germany, for example. So this, to me, is we're maybe reaching critical mass where enough people are getting into this, like Uber, where it's going to be awfully hard to put the genie back in the bottle.
The one thing, though, that holds people back from doing it is mainly the, can I do it? Or, you know, we both work, so how is this logistically possible? And these are the sorts of legitimate concerns that people have that nevertheless can be overcome. And all you have to do is go to a search engine and look around for homeschooling discussion forums. And I guarantee you, there are posts from families that want to pull the trigger on this and do it, but they just don't know, can I? Am I smart enough? And they have all the self-doubt and how would we have the time? But the thing is, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, the pioneering families out there that were there at the very beginning of homeschooling, the modern homeschooling movement, they've already answered all this. They've already built the infrastructure to help you do it. So if the reason you're not doing it is that you have a really, really great private school that you're happy with, well, that's one thing. But if the reason you're not doing it is that you don't think you can, don't leave the conversation in your mind there before you go do some well-placed search engine searches to see what the answers to that are, because there are answers.
Yeah, and I don't think teachers' unions did themselves any favors during COVID saying, we can't come back to the classroom, we're going to die. And I don't think teachers' unions in Florida right now, in response to this DeSantis bill, are doing themselves any favors, because I think the average parent, Tom, they want, especially their young boy or girl, let's say in elementary school, they want them to go to school and be kind and open and loving towards people who are different, whether that's skin color, sexuality, religion, whatever it might be, national origin. But they don't want the LGBT stuff taught. They don't want it made an issue amongst their young children. That doesn't make them hateful. It doesn't make them homophobic. It doesn't make them transphobic. I mean, there's almost like a weariness to parents that you feel right now. And I think the left may be overplaying its hand a little bit on this, because I think a lot of people, Tom, are being awakened to the fact that this really is an agenda to make queerness a big part of elementary education, to get in between kids and their parents. And I think, especially with moms, it's entirely possible for the left to overplay their hand here.
I think they're alienating some of their own people. I think even some of their own people who would say, I have no moral problem with any of the things that they're teaching. What I have a problem with is the age at which it's being taught, or the wink, wink, hey, I'm saying something that I probably shouldn't say when you're only seven. We all know that's happening. If you don't think that's happening, you're living in a dream world. There's ample evidence of it. You can look all around you. It's everywhere. And so, yeah, I think that they've done it also. I think the polling data about where independents stand indicates that independents, by and large, a majority of them, seem to think that the wacko left has just lost them.
Yeah, and the sexual stuff especially. I mean, can't we all just agree that kids deserve to have an innocent period in childhood? And when I think back to my own experience going through public schools all the way through big lockstep, same ones my older brothers went to, large public schools, suburban public schools, and all the time that was wasted, the study halls, all that time when I could have been learning real history or learning a musical instrument or learning a sport or learning how to better cook or do metal shop or wood shop or learning how to start a business or learning public speaking or the art of conversation. There's just so many things that you could do with those childhood years. And Tom, as you know, learning is so much easier when you're young. The neurons in your brain fire better, the plasticity, the memory, all that is so much easier when you're young. How is any kid in America at this point coming out of public school, let's say at 18, without having a second language at the very least, for example?
And not to mention, with some plan for their lives other than, okay, now everyone tells me I'm supposed to go study for 4 years at some other institution. And then after that's done, I'm supposed to sit by the phone and wait for it to ring. And somebody on the other end will tell me that they find me useful. Well, that doesn't sound like you're really in command of your destiny. That's the only way forward. They get out of high school. They don't know how to sell anything. They don't know how to make a pitch. They don't know what their niche is. They don't know anything about business. They don't know anything about selling anything on the internet, which is not hard to teach people. But it's like they're being educated like it's 1953.
Yeah, they certainly are. And interesting about sales is you can go anywhere in America. And if you can sell, you can make a living. You don't need a manufacturing base. You don't need a bunch of big employers there. I mean, if you can sell, you can basically go anywhere in this country and live and work. But there's a lot of other skills as well. So when I take a look at this landscape, and I just wonder, how are we warehousing kids for this long? And not just to 18, but as you point out, really to 22. And then undergraduate now is $100,000 or something like that. And the prospects are very, very limited. And I will tell our listeners this. I'm in a position where I have a son who is on the cusp of undergraduate, and he may not go. He may not go. He's going to explore some other things, whether that means taking some classes at community college while he works, whether that means being a camp counselor for a while, whether that means going to a trade school. He's got a couple of interests there. Maybe 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, the idea that my son wouldn't go to college would have sent some nervous tremors through me.
Right.
And now I just don't think that's the case. Tom, we have 1 minute. Tell us how people can find the Big Classroom, how they can find Tom Wood's School of Life, and how they can keep up with you generally.
Well, now we have the tremors about sending them to school. I would just say go to ronpaulhomeschool.com and start asking yourself if you want to do this, because it's really, really important for your kids. ronpaulhomeschool.com.
Okay, folks, that's Tom Woods.
All right, that's going to do it for today. I'm not doing a whole lot of public events these days. I like to make my travel these days be for leisure. That's kind of how I've done it for the past couple of weeks. But I will be speaking at the Mises Institute Supporters Summit in October, early October in Arizona. And it's the 40th anniversary of the Mises Institute. And you can be darn sure I will be there. So save the date. I don't have it right in front of me, but Mises.org/events is where you can find it. And it's going to be a great time with a lot of great people celebrating 40 years of the Mises Institute. So that's enough notice, I think, for you to plan ahead and try your best to make it. And I will look forward to meeting you there. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.